The following teaching is part 3 in a 6-part series by Dr. Ken Boa, titled, Great Books Everyone Should Know, Series 2.
We will be looking tonight, I don't know what you were expecting, but we're going to be looking at The Imitation of Christ by Thomas A. Kempis. The Imitation of Christ is a part of a wonderful tradition of devotional literature that's particularly relevant to the church in times of social upheaval, in times of shallow cultures, and ours is surely one of those shallow times in cultural history, not unlike what it was in the first century in Rome. It invites us to return to some key Christian truths that have been forgotten or overlooked. The consequence of reading a book like this, and it's important to try to read it in a more fresh translation rather than something that's Jacobean, something like the King James. There's some more recent translations that try to bring it to our minds in a more fresh way without distorting the meaning of the text. Because it's difficult enough, frankly. This book challenges virtually all the assumptions of our culture. And in doing so, frankly, to read it is to be almost shocked by the truth, the potency, the clarity, the pungency of biblical truth that we've often forgotten by dumbing the gospel down to make it culturally palatable. And so what we're dealing with is something that is pre-Enlightenment. And it's good to go back before the Enlightenment assumptions that we've all tacitly embraced and to return to some perspectives that help us to grasp what are the real issues about life and death. And here's a man who communicates that extremely well. It's a book that combines both the heart and the mind. One of the things I love about Thomas A. Kempis, and this book in particular, is the way he has a clear, sharp mind, but he also has a passionate heart, and the two go hand in hand. He's kind of a scholastic in a way. I mean, he's a mystic, and he's a scholar. But at the same time, he tells us not just the what, but the how. He gives us some practical exercises and personal devotions. It's very, very practical. He focuses on the need for simplicity of life, and for moderation, and for disregard of possessions. He focuses on what it means to have peace of heart and peace of mind that the continual presence of God can bring. So the main thing we're going to see in this book is the idea of the presence of God and how that presence, practicing His presence, ushers us into a life of peace and perspective in the midst of problems and change and turmoil. And so he's going to be inviting us to a deep inner journey. He invites us to sink our well deep in the water, to another way to put it, a taproot, and to sink that deeply enough so that we can kind of be nourished and fed by the water of God's Word, so that we are not a shallow people, but a people who have a depth and a perspective on our lives. The power of this book is such that it has gone through some 6,000 editions since it was written, since it appeared in 1471. A remarkably popular book for a lot of good reasons. It has a universal appeal. And frankly, it addresses so directly and powerfully the problem of human frailty and the problem of sin and our own peccadilloes and human nature. Though our culture changes, our human nature doesn't change. We have the same problems we did then when he wrote it, about gossip and about the problems of talking about other people and not really understanding who we are and so forth. And how do we deal with harsh criticism, for example? How do we struggle with adversity? How do we deal with the problem of spiritual dryness? How do we deal with problems of motivation? He covers these issues and many others in this very practical little book. And I think that's why it's so permanent. It's so universal. It's fastened on the person of Christ. Particularly, Thomas A. Kempis focuses on the work of Christ on the cross. And he identifies the whole idea, if we are to be His disciples, we must take up our cross, and unpacks what that means. So there is a profound wisdom in this book, a clarity of thought, and a deep and burning, abiding love for God. Here's a man who speaks out of experience, not by hearsay, but you know he realizes that about which he speaks. He's no armchair theologian, but rather he's a practitioner. He knows what human nature and its needs are like. He knows human foibles, but he also knows about God's solution, that how we can deal with nature and infuse nature with God's grace and therefore raise us higher than we could ever otherwise have hoped to have gone. He's a very trustworthy counselor. And the theme of the love, the mercy, the holiness of God is also something that is tempered by, as I said earlier, an eminently realistic and practical approach to the issues of the spiritual life. He focuses emphasis on right belief as the key to right behavior. And he says that belief and behavior will mutually reinforce one another. If you are thinking correctly and renewing your mind with God's truth, it will affect your behavior. And obedience, trusting obedience and self-discipline will also enhance our aspiration for the love of God. And so the two go together. And how do we subordinate human nature to divine grace? How do we deal with the issue of personal discipline and self-sacrifice? He talks a lot about that. If I were to invite you to come to a seminar on the virtues of self-sacrifice, I rather doubt we'd have a large attendance there. But frankly, if we were to look at the Beatitudes, and if I said, come to a seminar that invites you to pursue the 8 Beatitudes, I don't think it would be well attended. Blessed are those who mourn, who are poor in spirit, who are merciful, who are meek, who are pure in heart, people who show mercy and who are peacemakers, who suffer persecution. I don't think that would draw a big crowd, to be honest with you. The fact is, in fact, you can take the teachings of the Sermon on the Mount, invert them, and you might have a reasonably good approximation of our culture today. And the Kempis was well aware of that, and he invites each of us, individually and corporately, to return to God's assessment so that we do not judge things on the basis of outward appearance, but on the basis of what really is true, based upon the authority of the one who has come into our midst, the incarnate Christ, the decisive revelation of God in our midst, and to bring us back to a vision of that which is permanent, that which is lasting. A Kempis will say that it would be foolish for us to invest our lives, to exchange our lives for things that are fleeting and foolish. And yet he'll say that many people have done that, to reach the end of a journey that, as they look back, they wonder what was that all about, and their one life on this planet was not well spent. That they, in fact, exchange their soul for things that cannot satisfy in the end. And so, like Christ, he says that we need to focus on those things that are permanent, that are unseen, that are enduring, rather than those things that are temporary, that are visible, that are passing away. So there's this whole concept of a philosophy. And you might well say that there's two philosophies in here. There's a philosophy of light on the one hand, as he focuses on the whole theme of the truth of God. And so he focuses on the idea of God's truth. But there's another philosophy as well, and it is a philosophy of life. And the philosophy of life that he discusses talks about the grace of God and how we apply truth into our lives. It is a book that focuses on the whole issue, again, of the mind, and he wants us to renew our minds, but he also focuses on the need for our hearts to be inflamed. So, again, the combination of mind and heart is something that is beautifully addressed in this book, and of course, truth is always meant to be applied. Wisdom involves the application of truth in real-life situations. Virtually every page has material in here that'll stand out. It's almost like reading the book of James. It's jam-packed with things that'll convict you. If you read it carefully and wisely, you'll realize this is something you may need to read more than once. It's something that sustains multiple readings because he's a master writer. There's no accident that this thing was translated so many times and put out in so many editions. There's no accident that this work has endured the centuries and will in fact endure until Christ comes again. When we're looking at a classic like this, it's a classic. It's one of the aspects of a classic is a book that will actually grow with multiple readings. You could profit by reading this book every year, much as if you could read Pascal's Pensée, another book we discussed in our Great Book series. There are certain books that actually age well. What's actually happening is, as you develop perspective, you discover things that you didn't see before. They were always there. You just weren't ready to receive them. And so the more you mature and get perspective, the more this book will speak to you, and you'll discover that it becomes like a friend of yours. I hope some of you have read it, and if you haven't read it, my desire is to motivate you to at least go through it. It's a short little classic, and it rewards, I think, the time invested. It's a combination of, as well, where he quotes from a variety of earlier writers, church fathers, of course. He quotes from Aquinas more recently, but then going back to Augustine and Tertullian and others. But he also quotes from some of the Greek and Latin writers. He quotes, for example, from Ovid and Seneca and Aristotle. And what he's doing is he's like a householder in the Gospels, where he brings out of his treasure things new and old and kind of puts them together for us. I'd like to give you an outlook on the book by kind of summarizing the architecture of the book. And what you have is a marvelous mosaic, and you could study each of the tiles, but it's good to see as well, back off and get the big picture. And really, if you looked at the book as a whole, you'd discover that it's really four books in one. In fact, it was originally in manuscript form, found in separate manuscripts. And these four separate books were then combined together and into one book, which is called The Imitation of Christ. Actually, that title comes from the very first book and the first chapter of the first book, which has that name, The Imitation of Christ. So the first book, is what's called Useful Reminders for the Spiritual Life. The second book, Suggestions on Drawing One Toward the Inner Life. The third book, which is the longest, deals with the matter of inner comfort, and it's as though Christ himself is addressing us directly in that book. And finally, the fourth book deals with the sacrament and particularly focuses on the presence of Christ in the Eucharist. And so these four books have been combined together, but originally they were indeed separate publications or separate writings that the author created. The first book, though, deals with this whole issue. The first part of this material deals, we can say, with the way of purgation. In conform to his image, there's one of the two appendices discusses these three ways, and I'm not going to show this very long, but if you want to see the chart, it's on page 509 of Conform to His Image. But what the early writers from about the 5th century on have been talking about are three ways called the purgative way, the illuminative way, and the unitive way, the way of purgation, of illumination, and of contemplation, of moving us toward him, this relationship. And I'm not going to go into this these charts, but it even involves things such as the dark night of the soul and so forth that were later developed. But the thing I want to stress is this. As I describe it, the first stage, the purgative way, involves a process of purifying the soul through renunciation, contrition, and confession of blatant sins and willful disobedience. So in this first way, the way of purgation, we're dealing here with a process that becomes more subtle as sins of omission and unconscious sins are gradually brought to the surface. We're dealing with materials that are kind of below the waterline and they become apparent, and we seek to renounce them, and it involves brokenness. As we discover, God uses brokenness, a kind of a gradual death to the tyrannous dominion of the ego, and sometimes very wrenching transfers of trust from self-reliance to reliance on Christ alone for the soul's well-being. That's really much of what he talks about in the first book. So the purgative way is a painful but needful process of finding Christ's life by losing one's own life, which is called increasing mortification, and thus moving from anxiety to the peace of simple trust. That's the concept. Now, that's something that dies very slowly in us. We don't want to hear much about self-denial, about taking up one's cross, and yet I can't get rid of that category. Jesus seems to speak a good deal about this whole idea of becoming his disciple by taking up one's cross daily and losing one's life to find his. So it would be foolish for me to play the game of text management where I manage the text by selecting those parts I enjoy and ignoring those parts I don't enjoy and supposing that's going to give me a good perspective of Christ's teaching. I do that to my peril, because then what's happening is it's the gospel according to me, rather than the gospel according to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So the wise thing would be for us to conform our thinking to what the gospels teach, rather than to try to conform the gospels to what we want them to teach. Otherwise, we're going to worship the God we want rather than the God who is. And there's a real danger in doing that. So when we find ourselves struggling with texts that our Lord says, things that the gospels say, the epistles communicate, I'm going to suggest to you that the problem isn't the text, but us. That it's our culture. We are more embedded in our culture. We're more children of our times than we might suppose and that we might want to admit. The second way that he talks about in this book of overcoming conceit and complacency and moving toward increasing self-knowledge. The second way is called the way of illumination. And the way of illumination, the illuminative way, has to do with spiritual, eternal progression. That is to say, a movement toward a growing realization, enlightenment, we might say. Realization of the presence of God within as one is increasingly consecrated to God. So as we move toward dealing with the kinds of things that would pull us away from devotion to Christ, he begins to communicate to us. He begins to reveal more and more truth as we respond to his loving and gracious initiatives to deal with these issues. And so, in this stage, prayer is less an activity or an appendage. Rather, prayer becomes more and more a vital reality that flows out of your being. Prayer becomes more of a relationship than some kind of thing that you attach to your life. Life takes on an aura of the mystery of God as one moves toward what's called learned ignorance. Nicholas of Cusa called it that. An increased awareness of how little we know. In my own view, the best scholars in any discipline are people who are beginning to become aware of how little they know. You will know more when you graduate from college than you'll ever know ever after. You see the idea? As soon as you come out of college, you think you know everything. And only with experience you begin to realize how little you know. So that whatever your field of inquiry is, the best scholars seem to be the ones who have a humility and a recognition of their abysmal ignorance, that we hardly know what we're talking about. But it's a perspective. You need to know a certain amount to know how little you know. I hope that makes sense to you. And this way is often characterized by growing love and an other-centeredness as we express the love of God through acts of love and service to others. So in the way of illumination, the more we come to understand who he is and who we are, whose we are, the more we are empowered through that realization of our security in Christ to begin to serve other people without having to have reciprocity. That we begin to serve people not to get, but because we know that we've already received all things in him. And so the more we do that, the more we express our love for God in tangible ways toward the people around us. And frankly, the toughest two areas in which to express that tangible love, and you know what they are, is at home and at work. And yet that's where we spend the bulk of our time. And thus, many people are tempted to somehow compartmentalize the spiritual life into something that you do other than at home and at work. Bible studies, going to church, whatever it might happen to be. But I'm arguing, actually, you'll learn a good deal more about your spirituality by looking at those two relationships, home and work, than you probably will about the way you respond when you're in church or in a Bible study or at a conference. I'll let you think about that, and I think you'll see it's true. Number three, the unitive way is the third category. The unitive way is this, as I describe it, as contemplation and abandonment to grace. It involves a growing experiential understanding of the mystery that Jesus summarizes so beautifully. You in me, and I in you. It's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And so what we see in this book is really a development of these ways throughout the course of this book. And as we move through there, we come to understand a little bit more about these three books. The first book focuses on this, the purgation. The second book on illumination. The third on the unitive way. That is to say, the disciple is led to choose God as his true and only goal. And so we have a way of union and peace. And then the fourth book focuses on how that union is expressed in the Eucharistic experience. So that really gives you a sense of the overview of this book. And that his desire over and over in this book is that God might be at all times glorified in us, that we rest in God alone above all other goods. And as Jesus says in the third book to the disciple, I do not seek your gifts, but yourself. It's a very significant difference. Most of us are taught to suppose that the way to intimacy with God is service to him. And I argue, and so does he, and I think others as well, that actually God's much more interested in who you are to him than what you do for him. If you focus on the in Christ relationship and practicing his presence, what you do will flow out of who you are. And I think that we see this again and again in the text of this book, as we'll observe. Thomas a Kempis was called that from his birthplace at Kempen near Dusseldorf, where he was born in 1380 in a very impoverished home, humble parents. He had an older brother who's 15 years older by the name of John, who became a member of the community that was formed by Gerhard Grote, G-R-O-O-T-E, who was the founder of what was called the Brethren or Congregation of the Common Life. Called that way because they emulated Acts chapter 2, where they had all things in common, and though they did not have permanent vows, they did communally embrace a rule of life that involved poverty, chastity, and obedience, the kind of monastic vows that we would see elsewhere, and they shared all things in common, their very lives as well. And so when he was very young, after getting some schooling, he left his home at the early age of 13 to go to be with his brother Thomas there in a congregation of the common life in a place called Deventer. And so he moved from there, and then when he was a little bit older, in his 20th year, in the year 1399, he moved once again, this time for the last time, to a monastery of Mount St. Agnes, which was near Zwolle, and it was there that he would spend the rest of his life. From 1399, for 6 years, he went through the period of being a communicant and so forth, and then going through his probationary period of 6 years, and finally took his solemn vows in 1406. And then in 1413, at the age of 33, he became ordained to the priesthood. There's not much more to say about him. From there until his death in the year 1471. 92 years old. Pretty old for that period of time. Perhaps the only thing you can say is he wrote a lot of books, and he became the sub-prior, master of novices, and he kept the chronicle of the monastery. He translated scriptures, actually by hand, translated some Bibles, not translated, but actually inscribed them as a scribe, and wrote a number of other books, Prayers and Meditations in the Life of Christ, Spiritual Exercises, The Garden of Roses, a variety of other things. He was known to be an eloquent preacher as well as a very wise confessor. And so we have him apparently only leaving the monastery two times in all those years. And even when he did that, he said that actually I was not well off for having done so. It wasn't good for me to get away from that. So it's an interesting perspective that we have. The authorship of The Imitation of Christ has been somewhat debated, but I believe, from what I've been able to see, that from this internal and external evidence, the evidence of his contemporary witnesses, the internal evidence of the material and so forth, its own style, that it was really written by him. I think that's the best evidence that we have for it. So with that, let's take a look then at the material itself. There are a number of translations, as I've alluded to, but I'm going to be using, the first time I read this book, I read the translation by Leo Shirley Price in the Penguin Classics edition, and it's a good one. It's a good modern translation. But I've come to also enjoy a newer translation by William C. Creasy, C-R-E-A-S-Y, that has been published more recently in 1989. And it's published by the Ave Maria Press in Notre Dame in Indiana. And this is a kind of a carefully crafted translation that seeks to make the book relevant to our time and still faithful to the text. That's what he seeks to do. So that it was first translated into English, actually from a French edition in 1503, but it was written originally in Latin. It's difficult enough, given our own culture, to deal with this book. Why make it harder by using archaic expressions and so forth? And you'll see what I mean when I'm almost afraid to do this with you now, because you're going to see, and I'm going to keep stressing, this is him who's communicating this. If you have a disagreement with him, take it up with him when you see him in heaven. But I'm going to be just pulling out what I regard to be some powerful, insightful perspectives and just making comments here and there in our remaining time together. As you know, the common language of scholars, monastics, and so forth was Latin. Therefore, wherever you went in Europe, you could assume that people would know that. That's why it was actually quite radical for people to use the vernacular, as did Dante. But we'll see that another time later. But that's what it would have been originally done in, as sermons were done and so forth. And, you know, there are still traditions that continue to our time. For example, at Oxford, the graduation ceremony is still done entirely in Latin, not a word of English. Kind of interesting. So they have some traditions die slowly. Now let's take a quick look at the first of the books that are called Useful Reminders for the Spiritual Life. He says, and here's what I have to do. I've just talked about the mosaic as a whole. All I'll have time to do is pull out a few tiles and just show you a few of these tiles and just give you a little look at that and so forth. And I admit it's highly subjective. I chose ones that spoke to me. You'd probably choose a completely different list. But once again, this is my class, and I get to choose. So you can just kind of listen along. But I do hope this little sampler, and that's what we'll call it. We'll kind of call it a little sampler of little nuggets. I do hope that this entices you to want to read it for yourself. And that's really what I'm after. So I'm going to be pulling them out, not always in context, but in the first chapter of the first book called Of the Imitation of Christ, he says, I would much rather feel profound sorrow for my sins than be able to define the theological term for it. In other words, what immediately he wants us to know is I'm much more concerned that I experience the doctrine than that I have a full orbed grasp of it. He's a practitioner. And he's not anti-intellectual. It's just that he wants to make sure that we come to experience Christ as a person, not a proposition. It's easy for a theologian to fall in love with a system, with a model, to fall in love with a system of propositions rather than a person who has communicated himself to us. And so it's good for us to realize that we're all tempted to do that, and it's better for us to realize that God is a deep and profound mystery and that no theological system will really be able to encapsulate all. We have to continue to review that and see, has it gone from the mind to the heart? If it hasn't, it will do us little good. He goes on to say, this is the highest wisdom, to see the world as it truly is, fallen and fleeting, to love the world not for its own sake, but for God's, and to direct all your effort toward achieving the kingdom of heaven. And so he defines the highest wisdom of seeing the world as it truly is. It's fallen and it's fleeting. So the true wisdom, as Jonathan Edwards once put it, that the wisest thing we can do is to treat things according to their true value. Thus, the most foolish thing we could do is to treat the things that are fleeting as though they were lasting, and the things that were enduring as if they were insignificant. This is why Jesus says in Luke 16:15, that the things that are highly esteemed by men are despised in the sight of God. And so it's very possible for a person to invest one's life in those things that God says are utterly futile and worthless. And so the most wise thing we can do is to discern what the real price tags are and to realize that the world defines the price tags in one way and the word in a totally different way. And it would be a prudent thing for us to discern what things really are valuable and what things are not. He goes on to say, it is vanity to wish for a long life and to care little about a good life. What good is it to have a long life if you don't really care about a good life? Frankly, the longest life you lived, and he lived a long life, 92, is as a breath of air in comparison to eternity. And so the point is, whether you live 22 years or 92 years, all of life is brief. And he stresses again and again, both in this book and in the others, the pilgrim nature of life itself. The pilgrim nature that we are sojourners and strangers and aliens. He talks about the danger of the excessive thirst for knowledge, because there's great discord and deception in it. It would be wise to be sure that when we seek knowledge, we seek application. If you want to learn something that will really help you, here's the true knowledge to go for. Learn to see yourself as God sees you, and not as you see yourself in the distorted mirror of your own self-importance. That's one of those passages that'll nail us. At least it nails me. Because if we're not careful, that distorted mirror of our own self-importance will cause us to be deceived. And it would be much wiser, he argues, and I think he's right, to see ourselves in light of what God says we are. In chapter 3 of The Teaching of Truth, all perfection of life has some accompanying imperfection, and all our speculation is not without some darkening mist. A humble understanding of yourself is a surer way to God than a profound searching after knowledge. So again, his invitation is to self-knowledge, to come to grasp what God says of us, and to invite the Spirit to search us. So he goes on to say, many people have chosen to seek knowledge rather than to live well, and they're often led astray in their lives, come to very little or nothing at all. That person is truly great who has great love. He is truly great who is small in his own eyes and who regards every pinnacle of honor as nothing in itself. He has a chapter called Of Thinking Before You Act. Again, he's very practical here. And he says, it's sad to say, but we are so weak that we are more ready to believe bad things about another person and to spread them around than we are to believe or say something good about them. We haven't changed much in all these years. He knows this only too well. There's something about us that almost loves to hear bad reports. That's why news is so popular. Bad news is particularly popular. The phrase, if it bleeds, it reads. If it's good news, it's not news, that sort of thing. Oh, we may have a few human interest stories here and there, but really, what really sells is bad news and bad reports about people, how we take that in. And we do that in ourselves as well. He says of reading holy writings, don't ask who said this, but pay attention to what's said. People pass away, but the truth of the Lord endures forever. I think that's why there was a controversy as to whether he wrote this, because he didn't put his name on it. Because the issue is, God knows who did that. I don't need to seek credit, as he's saying. In the earlier periods of time, in the medieval world, no artists signed their paintings. Almost never did we really. It was hard for us to know. Earlier artists, craftsmen, and so forth, did their work in an anonymous way. And the cultural idea here is for us to pursue fame to impress people. He is saying, don't be obsessed with success and material things, because otherwise you'll become restless. The proud and greedy never rest. The poor and humble in spirit rest in great peace. And so he goes on to add a chapter on avoiding empty hope and self-praise. Anyone who places all his trust in people or in other created things is foolish. Do not be ashamed to serve others for the love of Jesus Christ and to appear poor in this world. And so he talks about the virtue of humility. If you have any good qualities, believe that other people have better ones. That's a tough one, isn't it? By doing so, you will retain your humility. It does you no harm if you place yourself beneath everyone else. It does you great harm, though, if you place yourself above even one other person. Now, I don't think he's saying let's be deceiving ourselves. What he is saying is we know ourselves. We know our inner motives. We don't know what another is thinking. Humility would invite us then to have the perspective of realization that without God, we really are and have nothing, but with Him we have all things. By the way, may I parenthetically remark that the key to humility is not self-deprecation. The key to humility is focusing on God's grace. As you focus on the grace of God, then your eyes are off yourself, because frankly, there's a perverse form of pride that actually degrades oneself. As long as you're focusing on yourself, it could be self-adulation, it could be self-degradation, but as long as you're focusing on yourself, it's still pride. True humility finds itself preoccupied with the beloved and finds itself not looking at itself, but at the grace of the living God. And so one has the blessed riddance of focusing always and being obsessed with what we think of ourselves and what others think about us. Better for us to focus instead on the goodness and grace of God. In speaking about obedience for those under religious vows in another chapter, he says, run here or there, you'll find no peace except by humbly placing yourself under the rule of a superior. That's an interesting word. We live in a pioneer culture that really has very little room for authority. In our own time, authority is not really a popular thing. Our only authority we want to have is what we feel and what we think. And it's a real discipline, I think, for us to put ourselves under the authority, or at least accountability, to invite accountability, to seek mentors, to seek people who will give us guidance and take their guidance seriously enough that we will pursue that as something that God has given us. So that in our own culture, it would be wise for us to seek out accountability so that we do not deceive ourselves. Accountability is always designed to help us keep from deceiving ourselves. In a chapter avoiding unnecessary talk, it's proper, if it is proper to speak of what will benefit others spiritually. Now, I've got to be honest with you about this. I struggle with this issue of gossip, of speaking ill about people. And this, when I say gossip, I mean, again, it's easy for me to analyze people's intentions and motives and so forth. It's much harder for me to button my lip and not say something that's questionable. It would be much wiser for us to speak well of others, and if we can't speak well, to try to keep our speech short. It's just something that most of us, or many of us, struggle with. He talks about putting troubles to use in a later chapter. Sometimes it is good for us to have troubles and hardships because they call us back to our own hearts. And so he is well aware of the need for adversity, brokenness, and trouble, that God can use that material, even if another intends ill toward us. God is powerful enough to use that to drive us to a greater realization of our desperate need to be with God. And so we have this concept of, rather than having the simplistic notion that once we come to Christ, life will be smooth and easy, rather we have a more biblical understanding that God even uses pain and adversity to draw us ever closer to Him, with the realization that the pain and adversity is but temporary, and that ultimately we are being prepared for a destiny where there will be no tear, no sorrow, no mourning, no crying, no weeping. The former things will be done away with. But here and now, we fight, we wage war. We are in a battle, we are in a struggle, and ultimately, we are aligning ourselves with the one who will be victorious in the end. In a chapter called Of Resisting Temptations, he says, we've all been born with a fierce, self-centered desire for success, status, and pleasure that clashes with our longing for God. And so he argues that temptation has a way of revealing what we are. Our response to temptation truly reveals who we are and teaches us more about ourselves, really, than our successes may. So often we will learn about ourselves through failure and setbacks much more than we will through our successes. And he says that some people are spared from great temptations and are often overcome in small daily ones, which is the interesting one. Some people can do very well in the big issues, and then they're wiped out by the little trivial things that come along. This happens so that being humbled, they may never trust themselves in great things if they're so weak in ordinary ones. He goes on to speak about our motives of works done out of love and says that God places more importance on the reason you work than on how much work you actually do. I think that's a very important principle, because although he doesn't develop it, it's really not well developed until the time of Luther, this idea of the dichotomy between the sacred and the secular. That really remains till the 16th century to be more fully explicated. But this whole idea of what's sacred and what is secular, keep in mind now we are listening to a monk who's speaking to other monks. However, what he is saying is what you guys are doing in the monastery can be secular if you're doing it for the wrong reason. So he says you need to understand that. What appears to be spiritual becomes secular if the focus of your heart is in the wrong direction. And I think that the converse can be unpacked as well, that the secular, what seems to be secular, really is spiritual if, in fact, the reason why we do it is for the love of Christ. Even the most mundane, routine task can become extraordinary, splendor in the ordinary, when we do it for the sake of the Master rather than to impress people. Now, that goes back very clearly to Colossians 3 and other texts, but it's something that we need to grasp clearly. And that's why I say that all of us are called, really, to full-time engagement in ministry. That ministry will have different shapes and appearances, and some people's arena of influence will be larger or smaller, but there's none of us who really isn't called to minister to, namely, to love and serve people for the sake of Christ. And given our arena of influence, our gifts, our experience, our background, the more we become renewed by the truth, the more we have an empowerment through the gifts that God's given us to serve and invest in the lives of other people. And so this is a theme that I think is being renewed more and more, even in our time. He speaks of the monastic life and speaks about the whole idea of thinking yourself as a stranger on earth, as a pilgrim. But once again, you don't need to go into the cloister to think of yourself that way. All of us ought to buy into that alien and exile mentality. In this life, you have come to serve, not to rule. You'll rule with Christ, but here you serve. And so he serves him best who actually comes to serve others and realizes that Christ himself did not come to be served, but to do what? You remember how it goes, to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. And he said, if I have so served you, you should also serve one another. If I have loved you, you must love one another. If I have forgiven you, you must forgive one another. If I have embraced you as my friends, you are now to do that with others. And so he invites us to do that which he's already done for us. Jumping ahead, he talks about the training of a good, quote, religious person. And what he says is that progress follows intention. This is an important principle. The intention of earnest and well-meaning people depends more on the grace of God than on their own wisdom. Such people always place their trust in God no matter what they do. For man proposes, but God disposes. Have you ever heard that phrase? Man proposes, but God disposes. That's where this comes from. Probably the best known expression in the book. The path a person takes does not lie within himself. He says we have to examine our inward as well as our outward affairs. Then he has this meddling chapter on the love of solitude and silence. He starts meddling here, the person about willingly keeping silent, and we all struggle with this whole issue, that we do not really embrace enough silence. We often experience this problem of losing a cutting edge when we spend a long time in idle chatter. And so there's something about our lives that needs to be enriched and enlivened by silence and solitude. No one leads securely except the person who freely serves. No one commands securely except the person who thoroughly obeys. No one knows secure joy except the person who holds a good conscience in his own heart. He says that what we need is to draw close to those who seek solitude and silence. And he deals with that at greater length. Then he has this chapter on thinking about death. And what he says here is essentially this. He says you ought to master yourself in every act and thought as if you were to die today. And so what he says is that holy living has to do with a true perspective on the brevity of life, that we are pilgrims and aliens, and that we ought to live with the end in view. And so if we were to be truly convinced that we could really die tonight, that if we had no, that tonight was your last night on the earth, how would that affect the way you live, the few hours you have left? Well, if that's true, and if we cannot know, then why wouldn't it be prudent for us to live that way each day as if it could be the last? Because it would be a prudent way to order our affairs. And he talks about watching out for those things that irritate you in other people. When you see them in yourself, get rid of them. And I have found this to be true. I learn more about myself by what irritates me and annoys me in other people than I might want to suppose. Because the things that really bother me about other people actually are very true about me. And so I have to catch myself. And I've caught myself with this a lot. And so what I'm trying to do now is, instead of getting mad at them for whatever the thing is, I want to, I don't say I do this very well, but I want to ask, is this an invitation to self-understanding? Because why does that bug me so much about them? Because it's projection. We're seeing how that comes and affects us. So even well before the age of psychology, here's a man who understands really some of the dynamics, those three powerful dynamics that we all know about that are, make it possible for us to deceive ourselves in a boundless way. Those three mechanisms of denial, which he talks about, the second mechanism of rationalization, and the third mechanism of projection. That is to say, we project on others our own faults. We rationalize our behavior, even if it's behavior we wouldn't want to see in another, and we deny that we've done something wrong. We try to see things from our own point of view. I know this is quite theoretical to you, but I believe it's really true that we have a capacity to deceive ourselves, and he understood this back in the 15th century, understood the need for a rich inner life. And of paying one's attention to oneself, listen to these words that relate to this. We cannot trust ourselves too much because we often lack grace and understanding. The light within us is small, and we soon let even this burn out for lack of care. Moreover, we often fail to notice how inwardly blind we are. For example, we frequently do wrong, and to matters worse, we make excuses about it. Sometimes we are moved by passion and think it's zeal. We condemn small things in others and pass over serious things in ourselves. We're quick enough to feel it when others hurt us. We even harbor those feelings, but we do not notice how much we hurt others. A person who honestly examines his own behavior would never judge other people harshly. Did you catch that? The more you grasp what you're really like in your heart of hearts, the less you'd be quick to condemn other people. And so he says that an inward person puts the care of his own soul before all other cares, and a person who attends to himself does not gossip about others. You'll never be inward and devout unless you stop talking about other people and start watching over yourself. He goes on to say about the joy of a good conscience, the person who has great peace of heart pays no attention to either praise or blame. Now, this is a tough one for many of us. I know it's hard for me. I want to listen in to praise and blame. I want to hear, I get very, very serious about when I hear blame and criticism. And what's my first response? Immediately to defend myself or whatever. If I hear praise, you know what it's like. The human being's the only animal. When you pat him on his back, his head swells. And so we have that perversity about us. I remember, actually, it wasn't long ago, that I was talking to a fellow and having a one-on-one conversation, but I was listening to another conversation just to my left, and two people were talking about me. So I pretended that I wasn't hearing it, and I sustained this conversation with him. But boy, did that left ear listen in carefully to see what do they have to say. You see, the problem we have is that we are so concerned about the praise and blame of men that we fail to really be concerned about God's own views. And that we're more, if I have the fear of man, which brings a snare, what will happen is the fear of God will be lost. I cannot seek to impress people and be pleasing to God at the same time. I'll make a choice between one and the other. Continuing on, and we only have a few moments, but we can just pull out two or three other thoughts. People look at appearances, but God looks at the heart. People consider what you've done, but God clearly considers your intentions. Again, he's saying, Look below the surface. And the best surface to look below is your own. You don't need to deal with what's below the waterline of other people. You've got enough dealing to deal with about below your own waterline. Love all things for Jesus' sake, but love Jesus for his own sake, he later says. And that if I can love all things for his sake, then I can also then be a person who receives all things as from him and through him and to him. I wish for no divine comfort, he says, that blunts the stab of conscience in my heart, nor do I aspire to a lofty contemplation that may lead to spiritual pride. Not everything high is holy, nor everything sweet good, nor every desire pure, nor every affection pleasing to God. I willingly accept that grace which makes me more humble and reverent, more ready to abandon myself into God's hands. And then he discusses the fact that Jesus has many lovers of his heavenly kingdom these days, but few of them carry his cross. He has many who desire comfort, but few who desire affliction. He has many friends who share his meals, but few to share his fasts. Everyone is eager to rejoice with him, but few are willing to endure anything for him. And he goes on and develops this theme as well. Again, these are hard words that probably wouldn't play well in most sermons. That's probably good for us. This is the sort of stuff we need to hear, because if we're not careful, we'll go for feel-good theology rather than what is actually true and right. I'll just pull a few more thoughts from a later portion of the book. Many, many rich little gems here and there, but here are a couple others. Jesus speaking to us says this: you should make my will your own. Stop being enamored of yourself and eagerly do what I ask of you. Enthusiasm often drives you to action, but take the time to learn whether what you do for me is for yourself, whether it's what you do is for me or for yourself. Many is the time that I have engaged in ministry, and I look back and I realized I did it for me. And I realized that my intention was, outward appearances can be deceptive, but it's the intention of my heart that I have to ask. And so he offers this prayer: Lord, you know what is best. Let this or that be done as you wish. Give what you want, how much you want, and when you want. Do with me as you think best and as best pleases you, and in a way which will give you greater honor. Put me where you want me and use me freely. I'm in your hand, turn me around whichever way you will. So these are strong and radical prayers. And frankly, they're the sort of things that can really move us into the realization that prayer is far more a matter of discerning God's will and making it our own than to manipulate God to go with our will. It's a very different orientation he has. Let your will be mine, and let my will always follow yours and be in perfect accord with it. And perhaps the richest statement, and I'll close with this, is this rich paragraph in chapter 1 of book 3 of Inner Comfort. This is a passage that I think is beautiful and profound. Grant me, as he says it in a prayer, O most sweet and loving Jesus, to rest in you above every other creature, above all health and beauty, above all glory and honor, above all power and dignity, above all knowledge and precise thought, above all wealth and talent, above all joy and exultation, above all fame and praise, above all sweetness and consolation, above all hope and promise, above all merit and desire, above all gifts and favors you give me and shower upon me, above all happiness and joy that the mind can understand and feel, and finally, above all angels and archangels, above all the hosts of heaven, above all things visible and invisible, and above all that is not you, my God. What he says is, I want to have the single eye and the pure heart. And so as I tie this together, and there are many other passages that are rich and powerful and I think timeless, let me just draw the threads together and invite you to be a person who takes the time for solitude and silence so that you can be a person who has growing depth rather than to be pulled along by the shallowness of our own popular culture. Who is careful about what you expose your mind and heart to, and who is very careful to be disciplined about the things that we read, the things that we see, and to be a person who lives with the end in view, to be a person who transcends one's own time by not being parochial, But by exposing ourselves to the renewal of the mind, to the truth of the Word, and by the holy men and women who've gone before, particularly people in earlier centuries. Thomas Oden, in his book Requiem, talks about the fact that he has become what he calls a paleo-orthodox. And what he means is that he has come to focus on what was the unified vision of the early church up until the period of the Council of Nicaea in 325. Because then there was no Eastern and Western church. There wasn't a Protestant church and a Roman Catholic church and an Orthodox church. There was the Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. And there was a unified doctrine and understanding. And so what he says is, you know, we used to be told, don't trust anybody who's over 30. Remember that? It's funny what they'd say, those who said that. They're all well over 30. But Oden says it differently. He says, I don't trust anybody who's younger than 300. In other words, probably prudent for me to go back before our enlightenment presuppositions and to grasp the truth that there is a vision, a discarded image, as C.S. Lewis puts it, the medieval synthesis that has been lost, and it would be well for us to be a people who read, expose ourselves to things that cause us to see the things for what they are rather than for what they seem to be. To be people who embrace the pilgrim character of life, who realize how brief and ephemeral our lives are so that we live wisely and well. And the interesting byproduct, as we know, is that the person who loses his life in this way will find it for Christ's sake. That the one who lets loose of those aspirations of the world will actually discover the peace, the love, the joy, and peace that the world really wants. People suppose they want power, position, prestige, popularity. They suppose they want that. What they really want are not those things. What they want are love, joy, and peace. The fruit of the Spirit that is the byproduct of the pursuit of God. Those things which are found only by putting Him first and foremost. And then the mysterious peace of God that surpasses comprehension garrisons our mind and our hearts as we take the risk of trusting in Him and abandoning the illusion of trusting in ourselves and in the projects and the promises of this world. Father, we thank You for this opportunity to think, to reflect, to quiet our hearts before You. May we slow down enough so that we begin to think again about those things that matter, those things that last. Thank You for the words of Your servant who, though he is in Your presence, yet he still speaks to us, as do others. May we be wise enough to listen to these warnings and to these encouragements, to the comfort and consolation and counsel of these truths. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org.